Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our guest co-host, Dr. Cam Coleman. Welcome back to Your Health, Cam.
Thank you, Adam. It's great to be here.
Hope you're having a good day and week.
Yeah, and we've got some exciting news to talk about here.
Yeah, we're going to be talking with Dr. Emma Byrne, author of Swearing is Good for You, about what bad words have to do with good health. I take it that swearing is almost a universal phenomenon. Probably not universal, but almost. But it's interesting because sometimes you hear swear words used out of frustration, sometimes when people are angry, and sometimes to try to hurt someone. So it seems like all of these things are things that she's studied some of the science and research on. Looking forward to talking with her.
Yeah, it'll be really excited to hear what she has to say and to listen to the results of her research.
Speaking of research that matters, we're going to dive right into our very first one. It's about violent injuries among school children, and a new study published in the Journal of Adolescent Health that really, it just made me depressed and kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, so this is a pretty recent study, and these authors looked at data from over 4,000 school-aged children. They followed them through 5th, 7th, and 10th grade. And we should say that these kids were only in three cities. They were in Houston, Los Angeles, and Birmingham.
And they were looking at the types of injuries they experienced and if they changed over time. And at the very first time they studied them, they found that the number of kids, even in fifth grade, 16.7% of children had a violent injury, including 12.5% that had a firearm injury, 8.5% that had a knife injury, and 3.5% that actually got medical attention relating to fighting-related injuries. That itself was shocking, and this was in fifth grade.
Yeah, these numbers are really wild. And one of the other numbers that comes out of their study is that by the time these kids got to high school, one in three had sustained a gunshot, a stab wound, or some assault-related injury that required medical attention. That just made me think, wow.
One of the other things that was really surprising about this was to say, well, are those who are doing the bullying the ones that are more likely to be injured? Because I would have thought it had been the victims, but it was not. The bullies were 41% more likely to be violently injured than other children, indicating that if those who are doing the bullying behavior are probably putting themselves at risk of these sorts of injuries by virtue of some of the things that they're doing and associating with.
Yeah, so really interesting research. And as we mentioned, these data came from just three larger cities. And it would be really interesting to get a better sense of what does violence and unintentional injury look like for young children in rural areas. So lots of questions that come out of this research.
Yeah, I also think it's a warning sign for, you know, we've seen such dramatic episodes of mass violence on school campuses and so many places in society. No one is immune from this. No one's family is immune from this. And, you know, even though boys were more likely to sustain violent injury than girls, and African-American children were more likely to experience than other races, and those lower-income families, even said those whose parents were widowed had a significantly higher chance of reporting a violent injury. Everyone's at risk. We need to be educating. We need to be building community. We need to be doing more than we're doing to deal with this really serious physical mental health challenge.
Yeah, and we'll take it to the next study in the news. So this one comes to us from New Zealand. We're still studying children here, but this is a study about lead exposure during childhood and links to mental health during adulthood.
This was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal Psychiatry. And the reason they studied it out of New Zealand is because at the time when they were collecting these samples of 1,000 people born in 1972, over 95% of the participants in the study had blood levels above the cutoff recommended now, and predominantly because their exposure to lead in gasoline. And today, because of unleaded gas, that we don't have that exposure, but still children may be exposed to lead really older buildings through lead-based pipes and plumbing or through older buildings with lead-based paint on the walls.
Yeah, and we know that lead has been an important public health issue here in the United States. And in fact, the level that we determine what's a high blood level to have, that's changed through the years. So now we consider even lower levels to be high and unacceptable. And so what did this study find? Well, they found that children who had higher levels of lead in their blood were more likely to have lower IQ and lower social standing in adulthood.
Yeah, they had the effects on mental health as measured by what they called a P factor, a psychopathology factor, which took into account multiple different mental health conditions, substance abuse conditions, and really says that if you're exposed, it's not going to just affect your cognitive functioning, it's going to affect your mental health functioning. I think it's another thing to be aware of in those who may be struggling. We should be looking for and thinking about this as a possible exposure and doing everything we can to lower that risk.
And certainly something we should be thinking about and potentially monitoring for when we think about our friends and our colleagues over in Flint, Michigan, where they've had a crisis of lead levels in the water there.
Hear, hear. Let's talk about our next research that matters about what is called genetically modified food, GMOs, and what most of us maybe have some awareness of, we probably eat a lot of food that's genetically modified. Maybe we have a little bit of uneasiness, but we don't know or think that it's safe or it's regulated. And this was really looking to see whether or not, what is the science of what people know, and is it related to what they think?
Yeah, and this study really showed that people who have strong opinions are often likely to maintain those strong opinions despite maybe lower levels of knowledge on the actual subject. So this study came from the journal Nature Human Behavior, and it was conducted over in Europe and in the United States, but it involved about 2,000 people across four sites. And essentially, they just took a survey to see what did they know about genetically modified food and what were their feelings around it.
Yeah, it seems like it was inversely proportional. Their knowledge was inversely proportional to their opinions, which seems like sometimes not a good combination. This was funded by the National Science Foundation. We'll have our great health science librarians put up a link to this article. I think it's important for people to look at it and think about what they know and don't know and maybe take their own quiz. Our last research that matters is an important issue, and it's around gender stereotypes around pain responses. Do we see, if we were to see someone pricked by a needle and we can't really tell if it's a boy or a girl, but we see the response, are we more likely to think it's a boy or a girl? Are we more likely to take the pain being worse? What did they find?
Well, yeah. So this study was done at Yale, and that's exactly what they did. They took an image of a child whose gender appeared ambiguous, and then they asked a series of adults, over 250 adults, to rate the pain of that child in terms of how much pain they thought that child was in. And what they found was if these adults were told that the child was a girl, then they perceived the child to be in less pain. And that's really interesting. And another thing that the authors point out here is that men were actually more likely to rate their perceptions of boys' pain and girls' pain to be closer together. And it was actually the women who felt, if they were told that the child was a boy, to feel that that child was in more pain than if they thought the child was a girl. Really interesting results.
I think we should take pain at face value, regardless of gender, regardless of what we think. It's really the experience of pain that people have, and we need to take it seriously.
Absolutely.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Emma Byrne, author of Swearing is Good for You, The Amazing Science Behind Bad Language, about what these types of words have to do with health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Cam Coleman. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Cam Coleman. Today on Conversations, we're talking to Dr. Emma Byrne, author of Swearing is Good for You. I repeat, Swearing is Good for You, about what bad words have to do with health. Welcome, Dr. Byrne.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on our show. I know that you are across the ocean where you live, and your accent is not from the south of the United States. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in writing, and how you got interested in this particular topic.
Sure. So my background is actually in artificial intelligence, which always seems like a bit of a leap from that to the neuroscience and the psychology of swearing. But one of the reasons why I'm very skeptical about claims of things like the singularity or runaway artificial intelligence is that we vastly underestimate the importance of emotions and of feeling in the development of human intelligence. I was looking at the importance of pain in the way in which we learn things. And it was from studying pain and what it does for things like memory or habits or behavior that I came across this fantastic study about how effective swearing is as an analgesia. And I just kind of fell down one of those citation rabbit holes. You know, I was looking at all of the papers that paper cited about swearing, and then the papers that those cited. And before I knew it, I had this enormous pile of papers all about swearing on my desktop. And I was just fascinated that so much research had been done on this topic, and yet we still have a very unnuanced view of swearing. It's sort of, you know, you don't do it, and you certainly don't do it in front of your nan. We always seem to think that, you know, doing it in front of older female relatives is the absolute no-no, when actually the research shows fairly comprehensively that there are multiple benefits to swearing, and also that the people who swear might not be the people you expect to be.
That's so interesting. And during your introduction, you got me thinking, if we were going to program a robot to swear, we would probably have to teach it what swearing is. So tell us, what is swearing? How do we define it when we research the area? And how long have humans been using profanity?
I mean, that was one of the big challenges in writing the book, was trying to find a consistent definition of what constitutes swearing. Different researchers have used slightly different ways of defining what swearing or cursing or bad language might be, but the definition that I settled on was the idea that it had to have something that was taboo, some component that you think twice about talking about in front of absolute strangers, and that it could be used in a way that's very emotive, either as a means of making people laugh, or as a means of showing your aggression, or as a means of venting some negative feeling. So having that emotional import and that sort of taboo meaning were the two really key identifiers.
I think we'll have some difficulty having an entire show about swearing without somehow using words that connote some of those things. So we'll figure it out as we go along. And actually, I wonder, because you've been doing this for a while, how do you communicate about swearing without swearing? Or do you think it's okay to swear as a communication vehicle? If we were defining a word, we would just define the word. Yet we're hesitant to use that word.
Yeah, I mean, the research shows that if you use a more clinical terminology, for example, you know, you call someone a penis rather than a more earthy term, or if you talk about things in a way that is, it's called a minced oath, where you use words like, oh, sugar, that just doesn't have the same effect on us in terms of being able to manage pain, but also the activation in our brain and in our bodies. There is no direct substitute for swearing. So it can be very tricky. And in certain audiences, particularly public appearances where everybody's kind of signed on and knows the rules of the game, I'm quite happy to push a bit of swearing in there. But one of the dangers of swearing is that it is so emotive, and that there'll be people who are listening to this now who probably don't want to be blindsided by swearing. They don't want to have that visceral emotional reaction. And so when you're broadcasting, when you don't have an audience that's sort of consented to have that strong emotional content, you do have to tread a bit more carefully.
What can you tell us about what happens in the brain when we swear or when we hear someone swear in terms of our attention, our focus, our emotions? What's going on in there?
There's a number of really fascinating things that are going on in there. One of the things that's most interesting is that swearing draws on far more parts of the brain than most of the rest of our language. And the reason we know this is that for most right-handed Westerners anyway, the left side of the brain, the left hemisphere, is responsible for most of our ability to understand and produce language. Areas like Broca's and Wernicke's area, very, very important. But you have patients who've had the entire of the left hemisphere of their brain removed who are still able to communicate to a certain degree using curse words. We know that swearing is a kind of language that is preserved on the right-hand side of the brain. And when you think what's happening linguistically when you produce language, and what I'm doing now as I'm speaking to you, I'm having to coordinate a lot of muscles. It's the most phenomenally intricate ballet of breath, of the movement of my diaphragm, my lungs, my intercostal muscles, vibration of tissues in the throat, the articulation of my tongue and my teeth. In order to do all of this, as soon as I start thinking about it too deeply, I almost become entirely aphasic because I realize quite how complex it is. And normally we rely very strongly on things in the left side of the brain to ensure that all of that happens very cleanly, that it happens in the way that we want it to. But with swearing, you can lose the entirety of the left side of the brain and just use the parts of the right-hand side of the brain that are normally used, you know, normally show greater activity when we're processing emotional stimulus. And we see the same thing when we're listening to swearing or reading it as well, that the right side of the brain gets far more active, shows far more use of metabolic things. So in an fMRI scan, you can see how much oxygen is being used in the blood, for example, in those parts of the brain when you hear swearing. And that, to me, is utterly fascinating. The idea that we thought that language was compartmentalized to these various small parts of the brain, and realizing that actually, a strong language at least, we're pulling on completely different parts of the brain in an entirely different hemisphere, and they alone can be enough to take over, to essentially, in computer science terms, we call this redundancy, the ability to have something that can step in and take over when something else stops working.
Let's talk about some examples and what's happening differently. I mean, when you take a hammer and you hit your fingernail instead of the nail on the head, and your first thing is that there's an F word that usually comes out, and you want to say, is it the same reaction if you use the four-letter word if you say fudge? But it has to be done exceedingly loud and spontaneous. Do you get the same reaction in the brain? And then the second example I want to ask you about is my boys were really great tennis players, but they would get frustrated at times. And at times, you know, particularly if they had lost a really tough match, they could also have those words. And I remember saying, you can say fudge just as easily as any other word. Was I wrong?
Oh, I hate to say that you were wrong because there's lots of different reasons why, you know, we might want our kids to use language that's more socially acceptable. But when it comes to painkilling, fudge really doesn't cut it. The guy who did the original experiment on painkilling and swearing has repeated that and looked at these mince doughs like fudge and sugar. And they just don't help you keep your hand plunged in ice water any longer than just a neutral word like table. And also when it comes to things like the frustration of losing a tennis match, there's some really ingenious experiments that I touch on in the book that have looked at the effect of social pain and how related social and physical pain are. So both physical and social pain can be modified by the same painkillers, marijuana or we call it paracetamol over here. I think it's acetaminophen in the States. I may be saying that wrong.
Nope, perfect.
But those will help with social pain as much as they do with physical pain. Now, there's also a fantastic experiment that we did where they looked at the interactions between strong and weak physical pain and strong and weak social pain and found that you see the same sorts of interactions between these kinds of pain. And I won't go into the detail because it's a lengthy, we don't really have time to go into this lengthy experiment. But suffice to say, it's the cruelest experiment I've ever read. And it involved a fake questionnaire and basically telling people that their entire lives were going to be appalling and then submitting them to physical pain. And actually, the painful questionnaire that they were given was actually far worse than anything physical.
Hmm. Wow. Well, we're not going to subject either of us today to that.
Humiliation is agonizing. So
yes.
Saying swear words does help deal with that pain.
Well, we do need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue continue this really fascinating conversation we're having with Emma Byrne, author of a new book, a fascinating book on swearing is good for you, looking at some of the potential health benefits and the research associated with swearing. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Emma Byrne, author of Swearing is Good for You, about what bad words have to do with good health. I'm Dr. Cam Coleman, along with Dr. Adam Goldstein. And before we left, Emma, we were talking a little bit about Adam's story about his experience with his children growing up and using profanity in the setting of competition in athletics. And I can remember when I was growing up, my parents very rarely swore in front of me, and I think they made a point not to set a good example. But the few times that they did, I really remember it. And I really remember how upset they were. And I'm just curious, do we know anything about the impact of exposure to profanity during childhood and whether that has any correlation to behaviors or health outcomes or anything else later in life?
That's a really interesting question. I don't believe that anyone studied exposure to swearing in general and whether or not those words in and of themselves have any impact on people's life outcomes. But one of the things you have to be really careful about unpicking is the difference between profanity and the desire to cause hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often, well, most of the time, when you do a corpus analysis, you look at how profanity is used, certainly in British English. I'm not quite sure how much this holds in the States, but about 80% of the swearing utterances you see are used either to signal solidarity or sympathy or to request sympathy. They're not used in a combative way. In fact, my husband and I studied the Twitter streams of a load of soccer fans who you'd think would be the most abusive users of swearing. And actually, they generally used it. We found only one occasion when they didn't use it to express sympathy with other fans of the same team. Terrible game this was. They didn't use the word terrible, obviously. So a lot of the time, swearing isn't being used to cause offense or to cause hurt. But any language that's used to be offensive, to be belittling, whether it's swearing or a slur or even just words like, you know, referring to someone as a nasty woman, those things that are belittling and demeaning, they can have a profound effect on us emotionally. Swearing is good when we use it for good reasons. Bad language or hurtful language is universally just very, very hurtful. I saw a tweet from someone earlier today who was saying that someone had sent her a picture of his genitalia and called her the B word. And she referred to this, she talked about this to her mom and said how she was effing PO'd by this. And her mom had gone, well, there's no need for that language. And the thing is that her daughter was asking for sympathy about this hurtful occasion. You know, this person wandering in and flashing their junk at her. But her language was considered by her mom to be the greater infraction, and this person, you know, essentially flashing her digitally. Whereas I'm with the daughter here. I think that if someone does that to you, that going to someone and asking them to demonstrate solidarity with you by using these emotive terms is fine. But turning around and telling someone to F off or calling someone a bad word is far, far more problematic, whether it's swearing or not.
Well, it seems as if there's a difference between what I might call rare and purposeful. You're using words for a specific, almost strategic purpose, in this case, to align yourself with your family member, versus a commonplace use that doesn't seem to have any real emotive. You know, when you hear something bad, you might just, you know, drop an F word, versus, you know, every other word is a swear word because it's part of your language. Do we differentiate with that in your book?
Yeah, so there's some really interesting studies on patterns of swearing and actually how flexible people are at tone switching. And swearing does tend to peak around sort of late adolescence, and a lot of this is about trying to define your own identity, of trying to show that you are unafraid and unself-conscious, and that you are entirely confident in your life choices and the way in which your peers see you, which I don't know about your adolescence, but I know that I tried to project that. I certainly didn't feel it. So quite often when we hear adolescent swearing, a lot of that comes from a place of deep insecurity. Pointing that out to them is likely to just, you know, result in more swearing coming back, to be fair. But it's usually at that stage of life, it's kind of like whistling past graveyards. It's being done to kind of bolster their own feelings. There are some people who have unbridled aggression, and that swearing tends to go with other things like impatience and being explosive. But for most of us, it used to signal a kind of acceptance, a kind of in-group solidarity. So there are words that I only use around people that I'm very, very relaxed with. There are some words that I only use with other women. I don't use around men, partly because I don't want to offend, the guys, but partly because they have a certain in-group solidarity. There's a lot of this with the reclaimed use of some words and why, you know, I as a white person would not say the N-word. And it comes down again to this right hemisphere activity, this emotional content of swearing. I don't know what it's like to have someone yell the N-word at me and to worry for a moment whether or not that is likely to be, you know, an overture to a hate crime, to someone deciding to beat me. I know what it's like to have someone yell the B-word at me, or call me, you know, essentially a term for a prostitute that's much, much more rude and judgmental, and to know that that's often coming from someone with malevolent intent, which is why using the B word between women or the N word between people of color is entirely different than a man using the B word to a woman or a white person using the N word to a black person. It's just, you cannot possibly translate that emotional content across those boundaries where you don't have that shared experience. It just isn't possible.
I think it's really interesting the work that you've done to look at different patterns of swearing among different demographic groups. And you mentioned something in your book about swearing chimpanzees. And we're not going to let you out of this interview until you tell us a little bit more about that.
Basically, chimpanzees can be taught to communicate in sign language. And there's two sort of parallel projects that have worked on this. There's Project NIM, which many people are familiar with, but with a very artificial lab setting in which this chimpanzee, Nim Chimpsky, was taught how to sign. Whereas there was a much more detailed and lengthy and challenging study done called Project Washoe, which involved six or seven chimpanzees who were all fosters among a family and largely led by Roger and Deborah Foote. And they taught these chimpanzees to use sign language. And these chimpanzees then went on to teach the next generation of chimpanzees also how to use sign language, showing that this language was transmissible. But the other thing that they did was they potty trained these chimpanzees, because wild chimps are, they use their feces as a means of establishing dominance. So the one thing you really want to do with a chimpanzee, if you're having it in your own home, is make sure that it has internalized this kind of fecal taboo, that there is only one place to go to the bathroom, and that's in the potty. And we know that this taboo was very firmly established, because it got to the point where Watcho and the other chimpanzees wouldn't actually defecate in the forest. They would insist on having privacy and having something into which they could defecate and it could then be disposed of properly. They showed the same kind of Western fecal taboo that most sort of Brits and Americans have, that the toilets are private. But something really interesting happened once that taboo had been established. The sign that they had for that act, the sign is transcribed as dirty in all of the papers and the books about this, they started to use that sign dirty in the same way that we use our own fecal expletives. They would use the sign dirty whenever they were angry or frustrated with, you know, one of the humans or another chimpanzee. One of them even used the sign dirty monkey. She started to use the word monkey to refer to any primate who could not sign. So there's also a sort of a degree of class disparagement that they developed as well. But this use of the sign in a way that was, you know, not literal, they weren't talking about feces. They were throwing around the idea of feces to say that they were frustrated or angry or disgusted with someone. Emerge spontaneously. This is not something that, you know, that the primatologists were teaching them to do. But as soon as they had a taboo and a sign with which to express it, they started using it the same way we use our own taboo words. And that demonstrates that those two things, the taboo and the means to express it, are sufficient for swearing to emerge. Well, that and you know, enough of an emotional stimulus to make you want to express those sorts of feelings.
Well, this is really interesting, and we're going to put a link up on our website about your book, Swearing is Good for You by Emma Byrne, and we encourage our listeners to get it. It's a fascinating journey. And for last comment, as we're wrapping up, I want to just comment that, you know, you say in your book that swearing has taught us a great deal about our minds. It makes the heart beat faster and primes us to think aggressive thoughts while paradoxically making us less likely to be physically violent. However, you also say that, you know, you don't want to see profanity become commonplace. It has to maintain its emotional impact to be effective. What final thought would you leave our listener consistent with this message in your book?
Yeah, that taboo is actually really precious. Having a shared taboo in a society means that we have this special set of language that we can use. Having something that is just offensive enough that we can express feelings of, you know, solidarity, sympathy, displeasure, or even aggression, it's really important to have that means of communicating so that we don't rely on things that are more harmful. I really like the taboos that are to do with bodily functions. I don't want the words that are to do with our toilet habits or our copulatory behavior. I don't want those to lose their power because that's something that unites us all as a species. You know, everybody poops, and we're all the product of, you know, the meeting of two gametes. So those two swear words in particular, I want us to cherish those. I would hate for them to lose their power, because the only other powerful ones out there at the moment seem to be based on slurs, based on things that set us apart from one another, that point out the differences between us. So at the risk of sounding like a sort of crunchy granola hippie here, I want us to keep the swears that bring us all together rather than rely on the swears that drive us apart. I feel like the society that swears together judiciously is more likely to be united than the society that just swears at each other.
The paradox of your book, where you talk about the amazing science of bad language. We want to thank you very much, Dr. Emma Byrne, author, creative innovator, about putting together this research about swearing and its relationship to health. And thank you for being a guest today on Your Health.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. No cuss words. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Gross and Dr. Cam Coleman. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Well, welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If a listener has any question they want us to address, they can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. That's one word, yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
I quit smoking years ago, but switched to chewing tobacco instead. I'd like to quit that habit too, and I'm curious, are the programs that help smokers quit somewhere that I could probably get help?
Congratulations for giving up combustible tobacco. There's something called harm reduction, which
right.
Is there more harm in certain forms of tobacco than other forms, like combustible tobacco compared to smokeless tobacco? And the answer is the risks are certainly much higher for many serious diseases, lung cancer and heart disease, compared to maybe the risk with smokeless tobacco with oral cancer predominantly.
Yeah, that's right. But we're still talking about tobacco here. And the substance that's really addictive in cigarettes, snuff, chewing tobacco is the nicotine. We think about, well, how can we deliver nicotine to the body in smaller and smaller doses so that we can get you off of that chewing tobacco?
That's a strategy called nicotine fading, which can work for some people. Others need to be off nicotine entirely and need help with that. There are medications for that. Varenicline, some people know it as Chantix, actually is specifically made to kind of reduce and block the nicotine receptor and the dopamine and change the way so that you may not want the product. And unfortunately, smokeless tobacco is actually probably even more addicting frequently than even cigarettes are because of the pH and the way it's absorbed into the bloodstream so quickly. So people can have much higher levels of nicotine than they may feel. So the question is, do you need help? And you may be able to quit on your own, but you're probably 2 to 3 to 4 times more likely to quit if you actually talk with someone who specializes in tobacco treatment. And every state has a free quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, where you can get free counseling advice. And also, you may want to actually speak with someone to get some medication. And you could try, like at our University of North Carolina, our tobacco treatment program. And there are similar tobacco treatment programs at major universities across the country.
And it's not like you need to be on this medication for years and years and years. Oftentimes, people are able to get on the medication and see an effect in weeks to months in terms of reduced cravings.
Laura, what's our next house call?
My father's had cirrhosis of the liver for 10 years now and feels bad pretty much every day. His depression seems to be getting worse as his condition also gets worse, particularly after he recently was told that he likely had some cancer in his liver based on an MRI he had. He's even thinking thoughts like he may be better off not alive. Where can we find him help?
This is a difficult situation that we see with lots of chronic diseases and people as they get older and have their burden of illness be higher. This begs for involvement of mental health professionals to get some support.
Yeah, and certainly a good place to start here is with your primary care doctor and you just trying to get a sense of why your father's feeling this way. So starting with primary doctor, discussing depression and ways to manage depression. And another thing that might be appropriate in this sense is involving colleagues in palliative care. Those experts can really help talk about things like advanced care planning, goals of care, sometimes things that a busy primary care doctor doesn't always have the time to do in clinic. But I think the point here is recognizing that there are people in the healthcare system that are experts in this area and things that we think it's important to jump right on.
And we'd encourage you to act with due speed, to maybe be there with your loved one when they go to the doctor if they're okay with that. Make sure that there are no weapons accessible. Make sure that certain things could improve safety in the home, because we really hate to see something happen that could be prevented of someone taking their life in this particular circumstance. Laura, what's the next house call?
My mother recently fell, and her doctor referred her to physical therapy for strengthening. When she got to the physical therapist, however, they said it was more than strengthening, and they referred her for gait balance rehab. What is that?
You know, when we talk about going to therapy to get stronger, we mean in all aspects of life. Getting up off the couch to go to the refrigerator, getting out of bed to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. These things require balance. They require steady gait. And our colleagues in physical therapy who are experts at strengthening certain muscle groups help us really do better at these things that most of us just think of as getting stronger.
Yeah, I saw a trainer recently working with a client, had them sit down, stand up. And that simple act of going from a sitting to a standing without pushing up on the arms of the chair, use muscles, that really worked on gait and balance. They had a walker for gait and then balance, you know, practicing some things that throw you off a little bit, but you learn how to shift your balance a little bit. Well, that'll conclude the house calls for our show today. And we want to thank all of you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've answered questions that are important to you and your health. You can send us any question to yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes, or use our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our guest co-hosts again today, Dr. Cam Coleman, and our guest today, Dr. Emma Byrne. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of your health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Cam Coleman.
And I look forward to talking to you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.